Tyrion Joubert, who is the parliamentary candidate for the Capitalist Party of South Africa, ZACP. And the conversation comes from the following context. Now, speaking during an exercise in which the National Police Commissioner, Kathla Sithole, oversaw the destruction of 30,039 firearms at ArcelorMittal. In Vereniging yesterday, the police minister, Becky Cele, said that South Africa would be better off if only its armed forces and not private citizens had access to firearms. Now, of course, the ZACP, or the South African, the Capitalist Party of South Africa, disagrees with this notion, basically saying that this is contrary to civil rights. Now, this is what the minister had to say. Just give that a quick listen, and then of course Gideon and I are going to go into it very quickly.
What did you say, 30,039? We are looking at the next batch. We are trying to squeeze the time to be shorter, so that we don't keep these guns in the crime market for a very long time. For instance, from 16 to now, anything could have happened.
So as you heard what the minister had to say about that in terms of the destruction of these weapons. Gideon, good evening to you.
Very good evening to you, Gashul, and thank you for having me on.
Great one. So you talk about civil rights in this particular instance. Now, as someone that is very, very much familiar for my daytime job with you know, the Constitution, one of the things that we do not have in our Constitution is the right to bear arms. It's actually just an extension of legislation and common law. And therefore, you know, I think it would be difficult to argue in the Constitutional Court that I have a right to own a gun. Why do you say that gun ownership is essential to civil rights?
Well, it's because you have the constitutional right to life. You have the constitutional right to dignity, to freedom from violence. And without the means to actually protect these constitutional rights physically from criminal predation, that they become essentially defunct. Because what are they then other than words on paper? And listening to what the minister said today and seeing the National Commissioner there overseeing this thing, on the 30th of October last year, The National Commissioner told Parliament that the South African Police Service is overstretched and that it is impossible for the SAPS to fulfill its constitutional mandate. So they did this thing. There was, again, in the news today or yesterday about a police officer who sold their gun or other firearms to gangsters in Gabo, who then linked it to gangsters back in Mitchell's Plain on the Cape Flats. We had the Colonel Chris Prince saga not all that long ago when people, law-abiding citizens, surrendered their firearms during the, I think, 2011 amnesty, how thousands of these guns were then stolen by corrupt police officers and sold to gangsters. And of course, the very inconvenient fact that on average per capita, the South African Police Service alone loses about 8 times more guns than civilians, and civilian firearms are recovered at a rate 15 times higher. All these things taken into account, it's a bit of a ridiculous pantomime that is being played out. And if the Minister of Police, if Becky Cele, was indeed serious about keeping South African citizens safe, about being tough on crime, about doing something about a spiraling homicide rate, or spiraling rate of sexual violence, all these other things that I don't really need to talk to people about because we're, as a country, very much aware of the problem we have. If he was truly serious about this, he would reform the South African Police Service. He would fire the useless, captured senior top management in SAPS. He would employ career police officers who know what they're doing to those roles. He would get rid of corruption. We would get our crime intelligence gathering uncaptured and back on track. There is a whole swathe of things that can be done to get our criminal justice system effective again. To go on this tangent about disarming law-abiding citizens and removing from them, or talking about removing from them the ability to protect their constitutional right to life, when his own police service has failed and admitted at failing at their own constitutional mandate, just strikes me as disgraceful.
I hear what you're saying, but to a large extent, I mean, there's two things that we should separate here, I think, immediately, and it's obviously the ideal society where all of those things that you've been talking about, the corruption of police, the theft of weapons from you know, through this gun amnesty process and just generally guns going missing from police stations and so on and so forth, and police being negligent enough to lose their guns. I mean, that is obviously a serious problem in itself. But I mean, if we had to remove those factors and we had to introduce what you were saying, an effective police service, would there then still be a need for this bearing of arms? And I'm asking that question especially within the context of the American system. It's a constitutional right in the US to actually bear arms, and that obviously dates back to their 1776 history, where that gave Americans who were opposed to British rule and colonialism at the time the opportunity to fight back to an unjust system, or what they perceived as an unjust system. We don't have a similar baggage or similar problem in this country where we need to arm ourselves against a government that could oppress us. But arming yourself, as you said, is either for sports, hunting, or private defense. So if we had to remove that need for private defense, would there still be a need to, inverted commas, bear arms in South Africa?
Absolutely, because regardless of how effective our criminal justice system is or our police are, you will always be the first responder to your personal crime scene. Nobody else can get there for you. There's no Star Trek system that can beam a policeman down right next to you to be your personal bodyguard when a criminal predator attacks you. And I think what separates the issue of, you know, why civilian gun ownership might be desirable or undesirable, if you look at our rate of gun ownership in South Africa, lawful gun ownership, it's pathetically low. I think the last numbers I looked at was like 9.9 guns per 100 people, where we have societies, Scandinavian countries like Finland, which is well over 33 per 100. Sweden has an extremely high rate of ownership, as does Iceland, as does Norway and Switzerland, and funnily enough, even Italy, and especially Malta. And these are all countries that no one considers to be toxic or violent or anything like that. Yet we get people who say, yeah, but they don't have the same gun culture as America. And I say, but they still have a gun culture, a healthy one, where people understand what firearm ownership, responsible lawful firearm ownership, is about, what the risks are of abusing it, and that it is almost ingrained in their societies how to be responsible and law-abiding farm owners. That's the one aspect. The second one, when you brought up very interestingly the American Revolutionary War and the origins of the Second Amendment, if South Africans had, and this is obvious, this is a hypothetical, theoretical question, there is no necessarily right answer to this. If South Africans had the right to keep and bear arms, all South Africans, not just white people, in 1948, would white people have been able to oppress the black majority through the laws they would have written?
For me, unfortunately, that is almost a bit of a red herring. And I take it from the perspective that this was obviously an unjust system that stripped people, number one, of their right to citizenship, made them innately unequal on all bases. And juxtaposed to that, post-1994, at least, from 1993 onwards, when we had an interim constitution replaced by the constitution that we have now since 1996, that is not a factor anymore. Or we have the right to equality amongst the other rights that you have outlined, the right to dignity, etc., etc. So in other words, all South Africans are treated equally or should be treated equally under the law, and that the subjugation that we saw under the apartheid system would be very, very different. And I mean, we know that unfortunately armed conflict, no matter how justified the cause is, destroys a country. And I'm very happy, actually, that we didn't reach that point whereby there was armed conflict and guns were freely available to all and sundry, and that we ended up in a state of civil war, from that perspective. But the other issue that stands up for me immediately, what you have been talking about there, is that there is these countries with this massive, massive gun culture, you know, where they have guns and they have very low crime rates. And then obviously juxtaposed to that, we also have the US, okay? And the US obviously has its own gun culture, and we know about the very tragic and horrible stories in terms of crime, in terms of people that just go on these mass shootings and so on and so forth. What is the big difference then between, say, the US, which is a gun-crazy country, versus, say, Sweden or Switzerland? And I was shocked and surprised to hear that Switzerland also has a very high gun per capita rate. What is the difference there fundamentally between those two societies? And shouldn't we rather look at those differences than just merely the fact that people are allowed to carry pistols?
Well, there are two things that fundamentally come to the front, and it's a massive difference between European culture and obviously American culture. If you look at, and this is an interesting one, the road death rate, or people being killed, either as pedestrians or drivers, per 100,000. America's is much higher than any country in the rest of Europe. Does this infer that they're more irresponsible drivers or that their cars are more dangerous? I don't know. I don't have access to that kind of data, but there is a clear difference to how Americans do things versus how Europeans do things. The other second point is, if you start looking into the data of so-called gun violence in America and the deaths pertaining to that, the vast majority of it is related to gang violence in the inner cities of a select few metros, which have not been addressed over decades of it existing. It's very difficult to make meaningful cross-country comparisons, but that doesn't mean that you can't learn something from it anyway. So what I think South Africa would need to do is something that we fortunately seem to be doing, and it's encouraging competent, lawful, law-abiding firearm ownership, which is exactly the thing that we stand for, is that a person needs to be competent first and foremost. They mustn't have a disqualifying criminal record. And by that, I mean that not all crimes are created equal. If you were caught as a teenager smoking grass and you have a criminal record today, that's not really relevant to say that you're going to be unsuitable to own a firearm, for example. And of course, you mustn't be suffering from debilitating mental illness. The other thing that makes America a difficult comparison is you've got 50 states, and each of them have their own sort of gun legislations that determine access and what you need to conform to before allowed to buy a gun. The South African system has problems, but I think our competency system is something that's very good. And in fact, it can probably be improved upon. Something that hasn't actually happened.
So, I mean, looking at that, and as you said, and I think it's a fair comment from your side where you said that, there is no specific research that tells us what the problems are in the US versus, say, for example, Switzerland or any of the other countries that you'd mentioned previously. And that's a fair comment, is that we don't know what drives, say, an American that has a similar number of guns as a Swiss person to then take that weapon and then go and instigate and start a mass shooting. But at the very same time also, what I'm also very cognizant and aware of is, just gun safety in general around families and incidents. And I know that those don't make up a mess of it. It's not as if every single person that owns a gun loses a child because the child happened to play with a gun. But those are also factors that we need to start taking into consideration. So ask differently. Would it be necessary for us to be a gun-toting, gun-promoting country if we started solving in realistic terms and in proper terms our crime problem, our inequality issues that a lot of people then say feed into the crime issue? Would it make a difference at all?
Well, I don't think they need to be mutually exclusive things, because solving crime and solving inequality, solving poverty as such, which is also not the same as inequality, but solving our massive socioeconomic problems in this country need to happen. That's a non-negotiable. At the same time, people also, if you're competent and law-abiding, you deserve the right to choose whether or not you wish to defend your family with a firearm. I'll give you a practical example. I'm away on holiday at the moment with my extended family, which includes some very small children between the ages of 3 and 8. And I have my legally licensed firearm on my person. And the first thing I do in the morning when I get up is I ensure that it is on my person strapped to me, and it's the last thing that leaves me at night when I go to bed, where it's also within my control still. Because I am aware that there are small children in the house, I am not willing to take the risk because it might be uncomfortable for me as a gun owner to even for a minute leave it lying around outside of my control, which is in any case not legal. And it is not something that just comes naturally. It's because I was taught this, because I was brought up in, as one can call it, a responsible gun culture, which is something that if we are going to promote the choice to people, then we must promote it within the framework of lawfulness and responsibility, which means that it is definitely not for everybody. But if someone is willing to make the personal sacrifices to conform to what is necessary, then they should not be denied that choice because politicians are uncomfortable with the idea.
It's not just politicians, because what I'm just thinking about, you know, just from what you had outlined there in your responsible gun behavior, I can accept it, that you're a responsible party, that you treat your gun with the due respect that is required, et cetera, et cetera. And that there's many other people that fall in the same category, because I'm sure that there are people that wouldn't want their licenses withdrawn. They wouldn't want to be denied the right to bear arms, all because, you know, they're misbehaving with their guns and they, I don't know, when there's a party, they decide to fire it into the air or something ridiculous like that. And you know that we've seen footage and images of this type of behavior, whether it be people at a party or people who just get excited because of, I don't know, whatever political event is happening, then they decide to fire off weapons. But the fact of, for me, what immediately then stands out in that instance also is the fact that obviously in South Africa, the big difference is also the culture of the gun battle. And why I'm saying the culture of the gun battle is all too often the criminals bear arms themselves and they are willing and able to use those particular weapons. And that then puts basically not just people at the risk of being caught in a crossfire, but it escalates the situation because of gun ownership. They want to steal the gun. They want to fight back because they want to get a particular issue. And we've seen enough instances of that also ending tragically. I mean, isn't that in itself a factor that we should be concerned about?
Well, I've seen far too many people just in cold blood murdered in their driveways for their car or murdered in front of their families after fully complying with criminals as it is. I've seen very few instances of responsible gun owners engaging armed criminals in the mall in a running gun battle. And I think if you had to speak to any number of them, that would be something they would tell you straight away is not on their priority list. It is to get away and let the police deal with the situation. At the same time, I have a great many friends and people that I know that had the capacity to save their own lives and the lives of their families because they were armed and capable of responding at the time when they were being attacked by violent criminals. And some of them ended up in the hospital and grievously injured, but at least alive and nothing bad happened to their families. So it's a bit of a chicken and egg sort of...
No, that's exactly what I was thinking, to be honest with you. I was thinking that it is a chicken and egg scenario. I mean, I'm listening to you, and don't get me wrong, is I myself personally don't own a weapon. I try to take whatever precautions I possibly can in keeping my family safe without necessarily having to have a gun. And a very good friend of mine, one of my best friends, actually told me years back when I was on the cusp of leaving university and starting work, you know, I was considering owning a gun at the time. And he said to me one day, "Gershwell, the interesting thing for me is," and I know it sounds very philosophical and very cliched, but he said to me, "I think that if you have a gun, you'd find a reason to use it, versus not having a gun, you would never be in a position whereby you would need to or could use it." So I take that latter option of rather not owning one. But obviously, it's up to people to decide what their security needs are and how they want to enforce that particular security. Do you believe, though, that all South Africans would be as... all gun owners, rather, would be as responsible as you are, Gideon, based on what you had explained and outlined in terms of your behavior around firearms? Because I'm a bit worried about the fact that, for example, we have a high murder rate within the home, murder-suicide rates, where it's policemen or police officers, as an example, people who are trained to use guns, people who know how to use these things, and they're the ones that end up taking the lives of their families, for example, and their partners because of a dispute or an argument. We had a cop that recently burst into court and shot his partner in court in front of everyone and then proceeded to shoot himself. with their type of gun violence also, you know, it worries me that not everyone is necessarily as responsible as you had pointed out. And
sorry for interrupting you.
No, go for it.
Please finish. Okay. Well, no, it's definitely not for everybody. This is where the person needs to make the decision, and this is also where the competency qualifications framework that we have in place is a safety net in this aspect, because you can't just walk into your shop and apply for a license. If you are in a long-term relationship, you need a spousal reference at this stage where they have to consent to allowing you to do it. And if at any point they are not happy with you to be cleared a competent person to own a gun, they actually reserve a very powerful right to veto, which is something that I don't think many other countries have. But we do, and so far it seems to be working. We've got about 3 million licensed gun owners in the country, and there are so few examples of them causing a problem to this nature that it actually makes headline news the day they do. With regards to the police officers that that killed their partners and the tragic almost level at which it happened, is police officers in this country do not receive remotely the support psychologically and psychiatrically that they ought to receive for the amount of trauma they're exposed to in their daily lives. It is a shocking failure of the system. It's something that I unfortunately have first-hand knowledge of, and it's something that is clearly not a priority to be addressed. And I'm actually surprised that our men and women in blue hold up psychologically as well as they do, considering what they go through, and especially considering the zero support that they're receiving from the employer.
I hear what you're saying, but I mean, also simultaneously, the one thing that stands out for me immediately, and I hear everything that you're saying about the psychological support, et cetera, the fact that you have the right to veto, in essence, gun ownership by your partner. But there's a couple of things that immediately stand out for me, is that that makes the assumption that people are in stable relationships with. So in other words, the day I applied for a gun, I am still with the very same person or connected to the very same person I'm connected, you know, I was connected with when I received my gun license all the way through a particular relationship. And we know it doesn't unfortunately happen like that, you know. I could break up or get divorced or move on with my life, et cetera, and have a new person in my life. And that person not being gun savvy, not being familiar with gun legislation or anything to do with guns, because they themselves might not own a gun or never have owned a gun, would not even know that they have the right to veto it. So I could be an abusive git, beating and smacking and you know, committing all kinds of sexual violence against my partner, and she wouldn't be aware of the fact that, listen, I actually have a right to call whoever and say to them that, and I don't even know who you call in that instance, and say that, listen, I'm not comfortable with this guy having a gun because he might take my life.
And this is where civil society, it's becoming very important for civil society to become involved in this debate, because you, at any point in your life, if you're susceptible to it, you may develop a mental illness that is a danger to yourself and others. There's no...
Or you could just be a dangerous idiot. You know, you could just be a violent person who somehow managed to circumvent the test and the competency test. I mean, I'm pretty sure that part of the test doesn't involve you sitting down with a psychologist that does an in-depth psychological analysis of whether you have violent tendencies, or you could develop violent tendencies in future in the absence of my mental illness, mind you.
Well, pretty much, because it would be an absolute useless test to do, because you might be absolutely fine at that stage of your life. So,
exactly.
According to Section 102 and 103 of the Firearms Control Act, at any point, you can be declared unfit to possess. The trick is to empower people who are threatened by violent idiots who may have a licensed firearm, to then empower them with information to say, you've got the ability to put a stop to this at any point. It's a very simple, short visit to a police station, and it's over. The major thing to not lose sight of is this is a very specific issue we're focusing on, but apart from tragic statistical events that happen to it, it doesn't occur very often at all, which is why we can talk about it, because it hasn't manifested in like a society-wide thing. Of the 3 million people that are legally licensed gun owners, the vast majority of them don't do this kind of thing at all. and they are quite normal, decent human beings.
Yeah. Look, I mean, it's always going to be a difficult one, and it has been an interesting conversation. And believe me, this is not me throwing out a red herring and I'm going to suddenly end the call there. But I mean, with all due respect, you have to agree with me that the more guns we have in circulation, the greater the need would be for private gun ownership.
Yeah, they would, because we want, if we're going to have unrestricted criminal access to guns as there is at the moment, I mean, there is no shortage of fully automatic firearms finding a way into criminal possession. The only real balance to that is a competent and responsible, lawful segment of society that at least has the capacity to defend themselves against it when the authorities can't be there. In an ideal society, no one wants to live like that, but we are unfortunately not an ideal society.
Thanks for that, Gideon. All the best to you. Thank you so much for the conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Cheers,
thank
man. You. That was Gideon Joubert. He is the parliamentary candidate for the Capitalist Party of South Africa. Interesting conversation, especially around gun ownership and